PageRank and its roots in the analysis of influence and impact in the sciences. With the advent of the web and later of social media, this originally elitist technique was transformed for a populist environment. In journalism and the arts, far from promoting the long tail, the large number of works below the bestseller lists, a concept made famous by the former Wired editor Chris Anderson, it tends to multiply random initial advantages, a cascading effect. The rise of mobile computing, of social media, and of new and allegedly more precise advertising options has simultaneously threatened the efficiency of much of journalism by taking resources from the producing of news and opinion to optimizing it for the algorithms of social media. The third chapter considers the efficiency movement in education. The computerization movement in higher education is almost a century old, dating back to Thomas Edison's dream of replacing what he considered 2% efficient textbooks with 100% efficient classroom films. Yet while computers have made impressive progress in educating themselves, there is little evidence in either test scores or popular culture that computers have done much for mass literacy or numeracy. In fact, they have been increasing rather than reducing inequality by multiplying the advantages of an early start. The fourth chapter examines the revolution in geography created by digital maps and geographic information systems, GIS. It frames this in the context of wayfinding, the skills used by men and women in the absence of compasses and even maps. We have grown much more precise but less sophisticated. The electronic map, especially when displayed on a small screen mobile device, is extremely efficient in providing information about a particular place, but much less so in putting it in a broader context, a hyper-focus effect. There are many times when the direct routing of a smartphone global positioning system, GPS, is exactly what is needed when detours are out of the question. But the fastest route is not necessarily the most efficient way to get the most out of a journey. GPS may be more efficient than human wayfinding most of the time, but it can weaken one of humanity's most valuable skills. The fifth chapter on medicine considers the obstacles to efficient medicine created by programs for medical efficiency. Laboratory automation is one of the outstanding successes of computerization. The cost of sequencing a human genome is now within the reach of the middle class. The interpretation of genetic information has been much less straightforward so far. The electronic medical record, once promised to relieve healthcare providers, especially physicians notorious for ambiguous handwriting, of many of the burdens of note-taking. Instead, the need for both consistent and detailed medical records has increased the human burden, creating a new administrative specialty of code entry and a cottage industry of coaching providers on categorizing procedures for maximum fees, upcoding. Even when it is working successfully, medical quantification will have limits because patients are not passive recipients of interventions. Their culture, values, and attitudes toward life and toward risk, and their relationships with doctors and other providers can't be separated from outcomes. The ability of a professional to motivate healthier choices, an inefficient process of persuasion, often matters more than medications. Just as a book is a kind of place, just as a large format map is more than the sum of its details, but a territory that should be understood as a whole, so the patient's body and mind are a terrain, not just a set of notes and data points, helpful though those may be. The concluding chapter presents a heterodox view of efficiency and inefficiency. It is no surprise to psychologists that the extreme memory for details in which computerized knowledge excels can be detrimental to understanding. Drawing on the work of the sociologist Harry Collins in Artificial Experts, I will suggest that every human being has a vast store of tacit knowledge that could never be imparted to an artificial intelligence program in a lifetime. These intuitive understandings can inform our career decisions and purchases, our education, our experience of places, and our health. The consequence is that more algorithms should be optimally inefficient, taking more time for deeper analysis, as some search engine researchers have advocated, and providing what-if advice rather than definitive answers. Used unthinkingly, algorithms can be counter-serendipitous, but they do not have to be so. Their real problem is a familiar one, going back to the earliest market research. Established patterns, verified scientifically, can be upended creatively in ways that the data could never have predicted. Market research once declared that Americans liked weak coffee. Then came Starbucks. It is also true, of course, that unaided intuition has often failed. But findings of behavioral economics should not depress or intimidate us. Data analysis and tacit knowledge complement rather than oppose each other. Algorithms themselves need and are getting new approaches. The programming technique called fuzzy logic accepts the need for initially suboptimal solutions in exploring the world. Catherine D'Ignazio, who studied serendipitous computing as a researcher in the MIT Media Lab and developed an innovative news program, has found that major search and media companies have been trying to build more serendipity and information diversity into their services and recommendations. But it has not been easy. If more sophisticated and discerning algorithms are possible, it's likely they will originate in academic projects and startups rather than in the major platform companies. These initiatives and the insight of a new generation into the mutually beneficial coexistence of digital and analog thinking give me hope that technology, after financial crises and alarms of stagnation, can once again renew itself. Chapter 1. From Mill to Platform. How the 19th century redefined efficiency and the 21st has transformed it. We are living in a second age of efficiency. Journalists and entrepreneurs do not use that word as often as they used to. We'll see synonyms later, but never far from our minds is consciousness of the value of getting the greatest possible output from available inputs, whether increasing production or profits or reducing time. My claim that preoccupation with efficiency in the short term may harm efficiency in the long run risks being considered a heresy by some and a truism by others. I hope to show that it is an obvious proposition when one reflects on it. It is also obvious, as I shall suggest in succeeding chapters and in the conclusion, that combining efficient algorithms with holistic, analog understanding can produce far better results than using either strategy alone. But it is not always simple to defend the obvious. It is helpful to see efficiency as a concept that has developed over the past 200 years or so, and as a set of practices that are much older. The idea of efficiency, as we shall see, emerged in the age of the steam engine and was best expressed not by the 18th century metaphor of a shop's division of labor, essential as that remained, but by the substitution of continuous production for the fabrication of one unit at a time. The greatest enterprises invested vast capital and employed up to 100,000 workers or more to keep it in operation. Both classical economic liberalism and rival doctrines like Marxism reflected this model. It should not be so surprising that even communist governments admired Western mass production. The importance of technologies of uninterrupted, continuous process as opposed to batch production, was first underscored by the Swiss architect and critic Siegfried Gideon and the American historian Daniel J. Boorstin in the mid-20th century. Rollers, belts, and other devices changed the nature of consumption as well as production. Cable television programs like How It's Made reveal how much of today's industrial processes are already automated, especially when compared to episodes of the Industry on Parade series broadcast on network television in the 1950s. Today's programs will probably look equally quaint in even less time. But further reducing labor costs on assembly lines is not the kind of efficiency that interests us here. It is a new kind of enterprise that has, unforeseen by even the boldest futurists, taken over what Vladimir Lenin called the commanding heights of the economy, dominating its agendas. Silicon Valley evokes the mixture of admiration, fear, and scorn once inspired by the grimy industrial metropolises of the Northeast and Midwest. But while an approach to Chicago or Detroit or Pittsburgh by automobile or train can still be a visually striking experience, nothing on the peninsula south of San Francisco is tall enough to inspire awe, stupendous as its wealth has become. The server complexes of its companies are scattered as inconspicuously as possible around the globe. Yet the giants of Silicon Valley have ideas about social organization as radical in their own way as Lenin's, and they share with classical communism a passionate faith in efficiency. This chapter will investigate the contrast between continuous process efficiency, which fascinated painters as well as photographers and filmmakers in its monumentality and awesome concreteness, and platform efficiency, which is far more profitable, but concealed and evanescent, and that takes a leap of artistic imagination to dramatize. It will suggest how matchmaking by electronic networks takes advantage not only of the steady, if recently slowed, improvement of the efficiency of integrated circuits, but also of the ability of ingenious computational techniques, algorithms, to multiply the speed of these circuits manifold. This efficiency raises a profound question, the chapter will argue. Why have these platforms apparently had such little effect on the self-perceived satisfaction of the United States and other nations in which they are most advanced? Why are citizens around the world so unhappy with their governments, so ready to look to extreme solutions? One reason may be that the platform revolution has been diverting talent and capital from other technological projects that could be more transformative. I cannot identify them, nor rule out that they are already well advanced and may flower soon. After all, the U.S. boom after the Second World War was in part based on innovations like broadcast television and dry photocopying that actually were under development during the darkest years of the Great Depression, along with Alan Turing's theoretical work that helped make the platform economy possible. The question, which I don't pretend to resolve, is why the platform corporation, so profitable for its investors so far, especially the early ones, has been such an underachiever. Enthusiasts will insist that major innovations commonly have troughs of disappointment. The best is yet to come. This is especially the viewpoint of Facebook and its founder, Mark Zuckerberg, who in early 2017 published a manifesto acknowledging mistakes and vowing to build better communities and a better planet with the help of Facebook's users. To many adversaries, such promises have long been silicon snake oil and future hype, to quote the titles of 1990s and early 2000s books by disillusioned technologists. To critics on the left, in particular, the new bosses are not so different from the old bosses, just equipped with state-of-the-art surveillance and manipulation in place of the goon squads of yore. Some wary journalists see an existential threat to their own profession in declarations like those of Zuckerberg. I am not sure any organization really has such power. I will suggest, at the end of this chapter, that the most serious unintended consequence of platform efficiency may be its opportunity cost, its claim on resources that would, in the long run, do more to promote real efficiency. One paradox of the movement for efficiency is that innovations that have promoted efficiency and rationality have arisen in spite of discouraging data driven by intuition and emotion. That does not mean that gut feelings alone are a more reliable guide than data-based analysis, but only that data, and tools for analyzing it, never can take the place of the imagination in foreseeing future patterns of human behavior. Most such intuitions fail. The exceptions fill inspirational and business books. Venture investment has a high failure rate built into it. Yet out of the inefficient maelstrom emerged some of the world's most efficient technology. The history of efficiency should rightly start with nature itself. As biophysicists have discovered, DNA stores energy far more densely than the most advanced technological systems. The control of gene expression allows complex and robust organisms to develop with stunning speed. Tiny variations in the genomes of fruit flies can produce strikingly different behaviors. Evolution has been prodigiously successful in optimizing the flow of information. Leveraging limited resources is our biological heritage. The quest for efficiency seems to be built into human biology as well, as revealed by anthropological and archaeological evidence. There have been tens of thousands of years of innovations in tool-making that sometimes reached dead ends, but occasionally produced masterpieces of functionality. Think of the Australian Aborigines boomerang or the Central Asian steppe nomad's composite bow. Is any cutting tool more efficient than traditionally forged Japanese blades, or sharper than the obsidian knives flaked expertly by pre-Columbian Native Americans? Turning to the West, many ancient Roman medical instruments were so well adapted to their purpose that similar ones are used today, and their quality was not surpassed until modern times. Roman troops were famous for their ability to assemble bridges and fortifications with a speed that dazzled their adversaries. There was even a kind of mass production of oil lamps, stamped and marketed with early trademarks. Recent archaeology has revealed more dynamism and technological innovation in the ancient world than historians of 50 years ago acknowledged. The slave economy, for example, did not rule out labor-saving machines like water wheels, just as steam engines were used on slavery-era sugar plantations in the early 19th century. There was a great deal of efficiency in practice. But the concept of efficiency as we know it had no clear place in ancient life. The ancient Greeks and Romans, and other Mediterranean and Near Eastern societies, including Egypt, had administrative and record-keeping systems that worked for centuries. But they had no doctrine of systematic improvement of output. The classical historian Peter Toneman has underlined that Roman society in particular was based on principles of patronage, loyalty, and obligation. There was no theory of wages, interest, or productivity. Prestige was often more important than functionality. Books were written and read as rolls that were stored together in chests. Writing was scriptura continua, no space between words, which space would have increased papyrus and parchment use slightly, but made reading and education far easier. The difficulties of reading, manipulating the scroll, looking ahead to determine word breaks, were part of the performance skills of an educated person. That kind of inefficiency was a feature, not a bug in today's terms. Europe of the Middle Ages and the early modern era was a time of growing practical efficiency, but also without an underlying theory. The black letter handwriting that seems so quaint and old-fashioned today was actually a relatively rapid and legible style of writing for those accustomed to it. The Romans had the optical knowledge and the glass-blowing and metallurgical skills to make eyeglasses, but there was no market for them. Aging literate people had educated slaves to read to them. The Romans made excellent cloth presses, one of which survives at Herculaneum, and could cast bronze letters, but they felt no need for printing. By the 18th century, Denis Diderot's Encyclopédie and its Scots imitator, the Encyclopædia Britannica, summarized the knowledge and improvement in dozens of trades. In The Wealth of Nations, Adam Smith showed how the separation of the making of pins into distinct operations by specialists could multiply the number of pins each worker could make per day. There was an even finer division of labor in the manufacture of needles in medieval Persia. Still, Smith was an exceptional pioneer. The 19th and 20th century sense of efficiency was not quite present. A 19th century political economist, whether laissez-faire or socialist, would be deeply interested in measuring just how much more productive a pin workshop would be than a traditional one. Many products were still made according to artisanal tradition and style, rather than after systematic study of customer needs. The French technology theorist Jacques Ellul has pointed out that the armorers who made swords for late medieval mercenaries each followed a craft tradition and decorative style without studying the ergonomics of combat. Every soldier had to adapt his fighting style to the instrument. No 18th century figure was more celebrated than Benjamin Franklin for his union of practical ingenuity with investigations of scientific theory, despite or because of the limits of his formal education. The designs of Franklin and his contemporaries, he never patented his inventions and encouraged further adaptation for fireplace linings, significantly improved the efficiency of wasteful conventional fireplaces. But late 18th century inventors still had no scientific way to quantify savings in heat produced per unit of wood. Only in the mid-19th century did thinkers like the brewer and scientist James Joule develop consistent units to measure heat production, the British thermal unit and the SI metric joule. The two inventions that introduced modern efficiency were the work of other geniuses of the early 19th century, now known mainly to specialists, the millwright Oliver Evans and the paper manufacturer Henri Fourdrinier. If we look at plates of Diderot's Encyclopedia, as edited by Charles Gillespie, many of the workshops were not so different from those of the ages of Leonardo da Vinci or Galileo. Masters, assisted by journeymen and apprentices, made each product, though Smith's principle of the division of labor was beginning to spread. Goods were still fashioned individually or in small batches. Oliver Evans was the founder of continuous process efficiency. He is less well known than Franklin, Eli Whitney, Samuel Morse, or Thomas Edison, but for two centuries he was at least as influential as any of these. As Siegfried Gideon wrote in his classic Mechanization Takes Command, before there was any real American industry, a solitary and prophetic mind set about devising a system wherein mechanical conveyance from one operation to another might eliminate the labor of human hands. Grain was raised to the top of the mill by a chain of buckets and conveyed by gravity through each of the stages of milling with belts, screws, and other continuous conveyances. Individually, these were not entirely new. Some had existed since antiquity. The idea of an integrated system that processed raw materials and semi-finished products was still a breathtaking step in efficiency. Evans's system seemed shaky, and he lacked Franklin's persuasive powers, but in The Power of His Vision, Gideon rightly concluded, Oliver Evans' invention opens a new chapter in the history of mankind. The second of the landmarks of classic modern efficiency was the Fourdrinier paper mill. Ever since its introduction in China, and to this day in the production of Japanese artisanal papers like washi, paper was made from fibers in individual sheets. Papermakers were highly skilled workers who formed powerful guilds. Books and newspapers were still costly. A French printer named Nicolas-Louis Robert was the first to understand the potential of continuous paper production. As the historian Mark Kurlansky has pointed out, Robert's invention of a wire framework used the principle of today's conveyor belts, but actually preceded their invention. The first use was by the Royal Navy for the manufacture of ship's biscuits in 1804. In his machine, a moving screen received the wet fibers and agitated the pulp laterally to distribute it evenly, as sheet paper artisans did. After the water was removed, the semi-finished paper was rolled onto a series of drums, the final ones heated for drying. The paper manufacturers Henri and David Fourdrinier made technical improvements in the Robert process, but not enough to make it practical, and they were forced to declare bankruptcy. It was the engineer Brian Donkin who finally made usable continuous papermaking machines on the basis of Robert's idea. This complex parentage reveals an important feature of continuous process efficiency. Even more than other innovations, it is the drawn-out result of failure, collaboration, and competition. The efficiency of production of paper, flour, and biscuits heralded 2 centuries of efficiency in the continuous production of consumer goods. Circular motion became ubiquitous. In war, it created the revolver and the Maxim gun. In peacetime, the humble spool of cotton thread, introduced in Scotland during Britain's wars with Napoleon, made possible Isaac Singer's sewing machine and the mass production of garments. Through the 18th century, thread was generally made of linen and sold only in skeins. The 19th century's most celebrated innovation, Thomas Edison's electric light bulb, had a limited initial market. Until the late 1890s, it took a team of 2 skilled glass blowers a full minute to produce 2 glass shells with methods that had not changed in 2,000 years. Thanks to decades of improvements at the Corning Glass Works, a new generation of automated bulb machine was able to produce 400,000 blanks, glass shells enclosing the incandescent filaments, in 24 hours by 1926. In the 1930s, the number increased first to 1 million, then to 3 million. Just as Nicolas-Louis Robert and the Fourdriniers proved as important as Gutenberg for mass reading and education, so the now obscure inventor William Woods used continuous process efficiency to realize the potential of the Edison bulb. Other mechanic inventors made possible the fully automated production and filling of glass bottles and metal cans, and the mixing of rubber in giant rotary blenders still used in today's robotic tire factories. On the farm, the continuously operating harvester machine replaced the scythe and the hand sickle. The grain thus harvested would by the 20th century be baked as it passed through ovens on continuous conveyor belts. Advanced dairies in Europe and the United States even milked cows in slowly rotating stalls. As Gideon observed, the continuous disassembly line of Chicago's meatpacking industry helped inspire the workflow of industrialists led by Henry Ford. And the very sheet steel that automobile makers were using by the early 1930s was made in a continuous roll process that was pioneered by a steel mill superintendent, John B. Titus, inspired by the design of his grandfather's Fourdrinier paper mill. Some of America's greatest 19th and 20th century infrastructure also exploited the efficiency of repeated rotary motion. The giant cables of suspension bridges from the Brooklyn Bridge to the Golden Gate Bridge were spun from wire on location by the machinery and workers of John Roebling's sons. Even news and literature were shaped by continuous rotary methods. Giant Fortunier machines turned out the rolls of newsprint, supplying the high-speed, web-fed presses of newspaper barons like Joseph Pulitzer and William Randolph Hearst. Shopping and recreation were transformed. Department store customers entered and exited through revolving doors and changed floors with ingenious, endless belts of stairs. And the West's great railroads, with their continuous circulation of vast tonnages of freight and millions of passengers, were the ultimate expression and management challenge of the mature industrial age. The ocean liners of the North Atlantic circulated according to reliable, fixed schedules, keeping to a wide band in each direction. Elite passengers came to expect a punctuality unheard of in the centuries of sail. If the captain of the Titanic had slowed to a safe speed for avoiding sea ice, as many subsequent writers and film directors have believed he should, the ship would have been over a day late, and he would probably be remembered, if at all, by marine historians for timidity, not prudence. While many of the inventors of the new processes rose from the shop floor, sometimes to great wealth, industrialists and the middle class alike were beginning to perceive that empirical skills were not enough. With continuous process efficiency arose a new set of values and a new lexicon that can be called the first efficiency movement. It motivated not only investors, bankers, and aspiring managers, but also members of the growing ranks of the professions. There was no single doctrine of industrial efficiency in the 19th and early 20th centuries, but there was a firm set of assumptions. The first was quantification. While it may not have mattered to Benjamin Franklin to measure the output of his stove versus that of conventional fireplaces, 19th century elites shared a growing enthusiasm for measurement. New statistical techniques were making it possible to present and evaluate data for more precise decision-making. The profession of accounting was essential to large enterprises, especially to public companies. The physicist and inventor William Thomson, Lord Kelvin, made the most famous declaration on this subject when he said in a popular lecture in 1883 that, "When you can measure what you are speaking about and express it in numbers, you know something about it. But when you cannot measure it, when you cannot express it in numbers, your knowledge is of a meager and unsatisfactory kind." Classic efficiency also depended on scale. While the left of the progressive movement feared monopoly, and independent producers and merchants claimed unfairness, left and right often agreed on the advantages of the big corporation for both consumers and workers. From the time of Andrew Carnegie's Edgar Thomson Works in Braddock, Pennsylvania, in 1875, it was scale that permitted the installation of the most efficient and expensive new machinery, driving down prices to put pressure on competition. It was scale that let John D. Rockefeller monopolize petroleum distribution and refining and control, much of it even after the antitrust breakup of Standard Oil. And it was scale that made possible the earliest industrial robots, as early as 1921, inspired by the Ford assembly line, the A.O. Smith Company of Milwaukee was selling a robotic machine capable of riveting 10,000 automobile frames each day. With scale came bureaucracy and professionalization. Even entrepreneurs who had learned on the job, like the superstar telegraph operator Thomas Edison, realized they needed degreed engineers and scientists, and American universities obliged with new technical schools and courses. One empirical occupation after another was reorganized as a profession with schools, degrees, and journals endowed by dynasties like those of the Carnegies, Mellons, Rockefellers, Vanderbilts, and Guggenheims. An ideology of codes, examinations, and credentials spread to include not only medicine, law, and engineering, but new academic fields like librarianship, public accounting, journalism, and business administration. Even on the shop floor, new positions like toolroom clerk were created to allow highly skilled workers to spend as much time as possible at their machines. With size, too, came the opportunity and responsibility for private planning. The efficient corporation was large enough not just to dominate its market, but to shape future technology from within. General Electric, DuPont, AT&T, IBM, and other giants were proud of their research laboratories. While Bell Labs is now famous mainly for its introduction of the transistor, no detail was too small for its research, down to linemen's leather belts and mechanics' oil cans. Even in the Great Depression, the Pennsylvania Railroad Laboratories in Altoona tested supplies of everything from light bulbs to dining car grapefruit, according to an admiring two-part article in Fortune magazine in 1936, observing that it was a nation bigger than Turkey or Uruguay. Corporately, it behaves like a nation. It blankets the lives of 100,000 citizens like a nation. The scale of great 20th century corporations also gave them advantages in the labor market, as described by the economist David Weil in his book, The Fissured Workplace. The large national corporation was able not only to pay higher wages and offer better working conditions than most independent companies, but it led the economy in healthcare plans, pensions, and other benefits. Low turnover of skilled employees further compounded efficiency. Classical corporate efficiency also depended on relations with government bureaucracies. Corporate executives fought government regulation and recommended their own style of management to improve the efficiency of government. But beginning with the First World War, and accelerating with the Second and the Cold War, many relied closely on government contracts. Historians of technology have shown how national armories advanced mass production when the ideal of interchangeable parts was still technically challenging and costly. IBM was rescued from the Depression by the bookkeeping demands the new Social Security system made on employers. IBM's founder and leader, the master salesman Thomas J. Watson Sr., simply had a correct intuition that the world somehow would soon need the expensive equipment he was stockpiling, and the ideas his research laboratory was developing during the early years of the Depression. His more rational competitors largely lost out. After the Second World War, the initial market for Fairchild Semiconductor's integrated circuits was almost exclusively the military and the space program until the mid-1960s. The demanding specifications of critical defense contracts also pushed Fairchild and other mid-century companies to reliability levels that would have otherwise taken far longer to achieve. Corporate executives believed they had the right and duty to plan the technology of the future. Company-sponsored exhibitions in the World's Fairs of the 1930s attempted to buoy the public with the wonders their organizations had on their drawing boards, including radical infrastructure changes that would need political approval. By the years after World War II, management academics and gurus encouraged corporate leaders to regard themselves as private planners of the nation's future for the benefit of all stakeholders. It was implicit that corporations like the Bell System, General Motors, General Electric, Eastman Kodak, and IBM could manage innovation indefinitely in the public interest. And why should they not? Since their well-funded laboratories had impressive records, and until the 1990s, newcomers like Polaroid, Microsoft, and Apple Computer generally complemented rather than threatened them. Even Xerox Corporation, perhaps the original disruptive company of the post-war era, did not compete with Kodak in photography, or, despite a brilliant research staff, with IBM in computer hardware. Finally, 20th century efficiency was elitist. As Samuel Haber, Thomas C. Leonard, and others have shown, the idea of a guiding minority directing less discerning masses was never far from reformers' minds, whether in industry, government, or education. Even one of the bitterest foes of the corporate elite, the rebel economist Thorstein Veblen, envisioned a new Soviet of technicians who could increase the nation's output 3 or even 12-fold. Mainstream politicians, Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson alike, endorsed the superiority and eugenic improvement of the white race and fretted about the reduced birth rate and suicide of its most intelligent men and women. The efficiency creed of the great corporations did not remain static. The authoritarian time and motion study introduced by Frederick Winslow Taylor, and anathema to labor unions, became kinder and gentler under the industrial engineers Frank and Lillian Gilbreth, who achieved national fame by running their household and raising their children according to the ideals of efficiency. Lillian Gilbreth sponsored some of the first research on the effect of seating on worker health as well as productivity. Paternalist welfare capitalist companies like the Larkin Soap Company of Buffalo, pioneers of the direct selling to networks of friends and neighbors that was later perfected by corporations like Avon and Amway, and the National Cash Register Company of Dayton, made health and cultural opportunities part of employee life. Frank Lloyd Wright's Larkin Administration Building in Buffalo, sadly demolished in the 1950s after the company's demise, was equipped with an atrium, an early air conditioning system, and an Oliver Evans-style flow of correspondence from the top to the bottom floors. For a few leading companies, efficiency became a way of life. The greatest change in corporate ideas of efficiency occurred in the Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan years of the late 1970s and the 1980s, when energy shocks, inflation, and labor discord challenged received ideas in business. When the management guru Peter Drucker published The Age of Discontinuity in 1966, what was remarkable was how much of the efficiency synthesis he felt had to be preserved. The global business environment had become far more diverse and pluralistic. We need government as the central institution in the society of organizations. We need an organ that expresses the common will and the common vision and enables each organization to make its own best contribution. On the moderate left, the Harvard economist John Kenneth Galbraith warned of underinvestment in public goods, but also accepted big corporations and labor unions as technological and social necessities. Even Soviet communism had subscribed, in its own way, to many ideas of efficiency developed under capitalism. Stalin's USSR openly embraced Henry Ford's modernist vision, from the mechanization of agriculture to the vertical integration of the vast River Rouge complex, which turned raw materials into finished automobiles. Russia's 5-year plans were based on the acknowledged efficiency of Ford production methods, and Stalin himself praised American efficiency as that indomitable force which neither knows nor recognizes obstacles. Soviet filmmakers celebrating collective farms were not ashamed to make the Ford logo stamped on tractor radiators clearly visible. To Marxist-Leninists, the contradictions of capitalism doomed it to periodic crisis and mass unemployment. Soviet planning would fulfill the promise of technological efficiency and surpass the West. A 1957 confidential report of the USSR Academy of Sciences, discovered by the historian of technology Slava Gerovich, declared that the use of computers for statistics and planning must have an absolutely exceptional significance in terms of its efficiency. In most cases, such use would make it possible to increase the speed of decision-making by hundreds of times and to avoid errors that are currently produced by the unwieldy bureaucratic apparatus involved in these activities. In the era of Leonid Brezhnev, Soviet planners and computer theorists believed that a centrally planned national network, which Gurevich has dubbed the Internet, could at last accomplish the economic goal of the Soviet state, the rational and harmonious development of the entire economy. The world was riveted by the virtual end of European communism in 1991, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, and the independence of former satellites. Vast complexes like Magnitogorsk, inspired by the Gary, Indiana works of U.S. Steel, and once the pride of the Soviet system, were now revealed as the height of inefficiency in squandering energy and other natural resources. When staying at the Moscow Hotel of the USSR Academy of Sciences in 1988, I met a Finnish forestry consultant who had come to help with perestroika in his industry. He mentioned that Soviet yields per hectare were only a quarter of those of his own country. But another kind of transformation was taking place in the West. A decade after the IBM PC and its clones had begun to transform office work, a new kind of capitalist efficiency was taking shape as century-old corporations faced crises and new empires arose. Not that continuous process efficiency was abandoned. It still existed and was making fortunes, but it had lost its excitement in a West that had long anticipated a post-industrial age. Contractors overseas could mobilize industrial armies of young people from the countryside. The two decades from the late 1970s through the early 1990s were a transitional era. They brought in a new model of efficient organizations and new self-identified and pejorative names, Reaganism, Thatcherism, Third Way, and the current favorite of the left, neoliberalism. The era from 1945 to 1975 now appeared as a golden age. The Arab oil boycott and the rise of Japanese competition tended to replace expansive optimism with fear. The first great change was reduction of administrative levels. Few people today have a good word for hierarchical organizations. But we have to remind ourselves that in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, the punctilious routine of European civil servants was the envy of American reformers bent on curbing patronage and corruption. By the late 1950s and 1960s, this was all changing. Even as some business historians and theorists, like Alfred D. Chandler, Jr., were celebrating the multi-divisional corporation as the embodiment of technical rationality, academic and popular critics were ridiculing its conformity, the tedium of the assembly line, and the mind-numbing routine of middle management bureaucracy. When Wall Street entrepreneurs began to challenge management with hostile takeovers and leveraged buyouts in the 1970s and 1980s, they signaled a new age in which share prices and immediate return on shareholder value outweighed old-style corporate statesmanship. The index of Drucker's Age of Discontinuity has sections on topics like management, unions, government, and knowledge workers, but no reference to shareholders or capital markets. Closely related to administrative flattening was the rise of the doctrine of shareholder value. Thanks in part to the growth of private and public sector pension funds, managers were under increasing scrutiny from institutional investors seeking maximum returns for their customers. This seemed at first to be a progressive cause, questioning management insularity and complacency. Ironically, it was New Deal liberals who first promoted this idea. Adolf A. Burl, Jr. and Gardner Means had warned in the early 1930s of the growing power of a professional managerial class, controlling corporate decisions without owning much of their companies. It was time for investor owners to assert themselves. In fact, Peter Drucker coined the phrase pension fund socialism in the 1970s, and devoted a widely reviewed book, The Unseen Revolution, to it in 1976. In the flatter corporations, more executives reported directly to the chief executive officer, and incentives like stock options became an increasing part of executive compensation. The results proved disappointing to progressive critics of the corporation. Pay became far more unequal, yet the new corporation seemed more efficient than ever. The troubles of the American automotive industry in the late 1960s and the 1970s helped catalyze a crisis of older ideas of efficiency. The River Rouge plant, so admired by Soviet technocrats, covered 2,000 acres in Dearborn, Michigan, and employed 100,000 workers at its peak in the 1930s. The historian David L. Lewis has called it easily the greatest industrial domain in the world, without parallel in sheer mechanical efficiency. While Ford always bought parts from thousands of small suppliers, the ideal of the Rouge was to begin with iron ore, coal, rubber, and other raw materials in a single integrated process, celebrated by photographers and artists of the time. Though General Motors, with its multiple brands, for every purse and purpose, and its friendliness to customization, seemed to be the antithesis of Ford, it still followed the pattern of multi-level bureaucracy, even more so than the autocratic family-owned Ford of the 1930s. GM even acquired suppliers like ball-bearing makers instead of dealing with them at arm's length. By the 1970s, outsourcing had replaced this insourcing. As the historian of management fads James Hoops observed, Jack Welch at General Electric was able to sell many units with the encouragement of his advisor, Peter Drucker, because more efficient computer technology had reduced transaction costs. The radical new model of the 1970s and 1980s was not GE, though, but Apple Computer. Unlike its rival, IBM, and the prodigiously expanding Xerox, Apple maintained a relatively small core of designers, marketers, and planners, and outsourced many of its other functions. Its researchers combined and modified others' ideas creatively, even radically, but it had almost no basic research to compare with IBM's Thomas J. Watson Research Center or Xerox's legendary Palo Alto Research Center, PARC. Apple's philosophy proved right in the 1980s when Xerox's personal computer program stalled, and Apple applied its technology to the Macintosh at consumer-friendly prices. Meanwhile, efficient manufacturing itself was reaching an impasse. A new generation of young workers who had never experienced the Depression were rebelling against management's search for ever faster production. Alienation, a luxury in years of breadlines, seeped from academia into popular culture. In many industries, what now appears a golden age of American manufacturing was tarnished by stress and fatigue. One reason for the later healthcare and pension crisis of the automotive industry is that so many workers of this era gave priority to early retirement benefits in their contracts. Along with a new style of executive compensation, a new model of the efficient organization emerged, the workplace fissuring, described by Weil. The essential cores of organizations are surrounded by contingent workers, often outsourced and rarely unionized, with high turnover. In the new corporate environment of the 1980s and beyond, management's image of the ideal employee shifted. Under the aegis of Frederick Winslow Taylor and Henry Ford, it was the person who would follow a fixed program determined by professional experts and do so until promoted to supervision or retired. In the new, flexible enterprise, it was the worker who would respond promptly and creatively to constantly changing policies. A former Larkin Company executive, the writer and publisher Albert Hubbard, created the first encomium of unquestioning corporate obedience in his 1899 tract, A Message to Garcia, reprinted in 40 million copies for distribution to employees of organizations from the New York Central Railroad to the United States Army. The pamphlet's ubiquity reflected the doctrine of efficiency in organizations around 1900. Almost exactly a century later, in 1998, a physician named Spencer Johnson published a similarly praised and detested parable, Who Moved My Cheese?, this time about mice who adapt to a new strategy rather than continuing to pursue their former goals. Instead of demanding single-minded obedience to an order, the new flexible corporation was ready to reward those adaptable enough not only to respond to, but to anticipate change. Who Moved My Cheese sold 26 million copies in its first decade, according to sources cited by Wikipedia. Critics accused each book of glorifying obedience, but there was a difference. The flexible subordinate was now portrayed as obeying not a single individual, a superior who would reward faithful and enthusiastic service, but inescapable trends of technological and social change that superiors also were compelled to follow. Indeed, by the 1990s, the flexible learning organization, sometimes explicitly inspired by the body's immune system, had largely replaced the old, stable, quasi-military structure in management theory. Just as flexibility replaced static hierarchy, privatism eroded whatever remained of noblesse oblige in relations with competitors and governments. Cold War corporations, not only aerospace companies, but technology giants like AT&T and IBM, had close ties to the federal government. In some ways, AT&T and IBM were monopolies, but they repaid their status with gestures toward the public good. As John Gertner pointed out in his book The Idea Factory, Bell Labs licensed the transistor to all manufacturers for the relatively modest fee of $25,000 instead of asking for substantial royalties. The technology of Larry Ellison's company, Oracle, with a 2017 market capitalization of $177 billion, was based on papers outlining an innovative concept for managing large databases published by the IBM staff computer scientist Edgar F. Codd in 1970, and never patented. There was a high opportunity cost to being a national treasure. Oracle's rise must have been all the more painful to IBM executives because they had originally shunned Codd's breakthrough as a threat to their existing product. The dissolution of AT&T and the Bell system in 1984 signaled that no company was too large or too respected to be challenged by newcomers. One of the pillars of the new efficiency was set in place. The Gilded Age fortunes had been made by combining formerly independent oil producers, steel plants, and railroads into giant organizations, justified as lowering costs through scale. Now, efficiency could mean dismembering them while they were still apparently fully functional. New, leaner competitors with lower overheads, including investments in research as well as bureaucracy, could undercut prices of formerly premium services and hardware. The fact that a previously unknown microwave radio entrepreneur in the Midwest, Bill McGowan, had been able to get the U.S. government to support his 1974 antitrust suit against AT&T, prevailing over the Bell System's overwhelming legal resources, showed that no organization was secure. A corollary of the new corporate model was globalization. Gilded Age trusts may have relied heavily on foreign capital and sold in international markets, but they were run almost entirely by nationals of their own countries and permanent immigrants. Today, a typical giant U.S. corporation may earn 80% of its revenues overseas, Taxation of this income remains a thorny issue. But as the business journalist Daniel Gross has pointed out, the headquarters of U.S. multinationals are also cosmopolitan by pre-World War II standards. Forget about influencing policy. Many of today's leading U.S. CEOs can't even vote here.